the last turf on which an entrepreneur can run. I agree that the turf is getting a little slippery, but I still think radio is like Lazarus in the Bible. It's still the medium closest to the people. You can't kill it. Television couldn't kill it, nor could cable or the internet. But greed just might finish us all off. Thank you.
William O'Shaughnessy, president of WVOX and WRTN in New Rochelle, New York.
Our next speaker.
Here on Pacifica Radio's live continuing coverage of the Forum on Media Ownership from Columbia University Law School.
Good afternoon.
This is Florence Rice from the Harlem Consumer Education Committee.
It's about time the commission held a hearing here in New York, and particularly appropriate that you have come up to Harlem to get a real world view of media ownership. The commission needs to begin to understand that the black and Hispanics of this community, what all people of color have known for a long, long time, black faces do not appear and black voices are not heard in the media in proportion to their numbers. When they do get into the media, a true picture of their life and interests is not present. Problems are distorted and manipulated for particular purpose, effective solutions are not presented. And I was deeply concerned about this a number of years ago, because every time I turned on my television, I saw black men being handcuffed, and the reporters who were reporting the news were so distorted, it upset me, because it made it appear that black men and Hispanic men were nothing but thugs, robbers, and murderers. So I wanted everybody to know I had a son-in-law, and he was a hard-working black man. His friends that I knew were all hard-working men taking care of their families, and they were not robbers, thugs, and stealers. I was able to get a day called Son-in-Law Day, which I celebrate in April. It's his birthday, April 10th. I try to do it every year. So I think it's important. I'll be celebrating Son-in-Law Day to honor black men this April. The opportunities for serious discussion about these important problems are limited. But there's one such opportunity I can give you beyond this hearing. I would like to invite each one of you to come and appear on my television show to explain to my audience in Harlem the importance of the ownership and control of the media to our democracy. In spite of a great deal of evidence that concentration of media ownership makes it more difficult for minority voices to be heard and minority people to be seen in a positive role that builds their communities. It appears that that does not happen in Harlem. The commission is considering policies that would drive the industry to further consolidation. Media owners who come from the communities they serve are better able and more willing to present and examine the issues in most of their communities. They tell it like it is, not like the media wants it told. The freedom of the press is supposed to be for all people, not just for the corporations who can afford to buy TV stations, newspapers, and cable system. The policy that the commission has put on the chopping block has not solved these problems by getting rid of them. It'll make matters worse. Larger and larger national corporations owning more and more TV stations and newspapers will become farther and farther removed from the people and this community. The voices of minorities will have become buried deeper beneath bland programming that sell advertising to upscale audience. Our voices are not alone in expressing these concerns. Dozens of minority consumers, low income, civil rights, and senior citizens, especially the senior citizens, because no one speaks about how landlords today are threatening older people and forcing them out their apartments. No one takes up that battle. This nation speaking out about the increasing domination of the mass media by a handful of giant corporations in the current proposal by the Federal Communication Commission to relax or eliminate limits on the number and type of media outlets that a single corporation can own. In fact, last summer I participated in a virtual town hall meeting organized by the Consumer Federation of America. At this meeting, more than 30 organizations came together to discuss the threat that additional mergers will have on the democracy. Following the town hall meeting, we adopted a statement of principles that I have submitted for the record here today. These principles advocate diversity of media ownership, open and available communication networks, media accountability to local communities, availability of public awareness to the public, engagement of community-based media, and the protection and promotion of consumer fair use and privacy rights. I thank the Commission for your interest in these most important matters and urge you to carefully weigh the impact of your pending decisions on minority communities. And I want to thank you. Thank you for being here.
That is Florence Rice of the Harlem Consumer Education Committee. We should point out she's one of many speakers who have alluded to the Federal Communications Commissioners. 4 out of 5 of them were in attendance earlier today. It's not clear how many are still there. But in any case, this is not a formal FCC hearing. There will be at least one of those in Richmond, Virginia next month. There's a report there may be another one in Los Angeles. We may be able to broadcast one or both of those on Pacifica. But this is a forum put on by the Columbia University Law School. And although FCC commissioners might be expected to pay attention to it, it is in no way a formal FCC proceeding. This is Dorothy Sigpen of Third World Newsreel.
There was a little bit of communication problem, so I found out very late that I was going to be doing this, so please bear with me. This is kind of a last minute thing for me. And I'm a terrible public speaker. I'm Dorothy Victon, Executive Director of Third World Newsreel. Third World Newsreel is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, surviving nonprofit media arts organizations in the U.S. We'll be celebrating our 35th anniversary this year. Our mission is to foster the creation, appreciation, and distribution of independent film and video, social issue, political video and film, by and about diverse groups and mainly people of color in their local and global communities. We distribute over 450 films and videos to universities, educators, organizers, festivals, museums, theaters, and television. During our 30th anniversary, the Museum of Modern Art did a two-week retrospective of our work from 1960 through the 90s. We also train hundreds of emerging media makers through our professional-level workshops and seminars. Our year-long training program is for aspiring and talented media makers who cannot afford the formal programs of places like Columbia University and NYU. We take pride in the fact that over 80% of our workshop participants move on to work in the professional media industry. Some choose to work at alternative media venues or independently. Third World Newsreel provides access and training to current technology, but it's in the context of media literacy and social and political issues. The students are provided marketable skills to gain access to the industry, but the main goal is to ensure that they use the technology to reflect issues important to their specific communities. The community, the African American community, Asian, Latino, Arab, gay and lesbian, and other marginalized groups. It has historically been a challenge to negotiate the media industry for minorities and women at every juncture, from bringing alternative media to completion, to distribution and exhibition of it. I'm just going to close right now. I don't have a lot to say, but I'd like to just express the concern that I'd like to present here to the commission, a question, and that is, will my constituency face even more obstacles in gaining access and having a significant voice and place in the media industry with possible consolidation and deregulation of ownership?
Dorothy Thigpen, Third World Newsreel. There will now be, if they follow the format, questions from the audience for this panel. Questions are submitted on cards and read by the moderator, who is P.J. Bednarski, editor of the Trade Weekly, Broadcasting and Cable.
The panelists speak into those mics and speak directly out to the audience and preferably the camera. They're trying to record this. See what we got here. Question for Florence. What effect do you think this will have, I guess, media consolidation will have on young black consumers?
Number one, as of now, they just wouldn't get the information. They just wouldn't get the information, and certainly that's what always concerns me for the kind of information many times is put out. And it's like the grassroots people are left out, because everything is geared for middle class America or the rich. So that's how I feel. It doesn't empower them.
Since you sort of represent the broadcasters here, but I'm not sure how well let me. Florence made a comment. She says more and more larger and larger groups, more and more TV stations in hand, further and further away from the community, from the people. That's sort of your point, too, right, Bill?
First of all, good, bad, or indifferent, radio, Harry, I think, is still the medium closest to the people, even in this high-tech, electronic, speeded-up day and age, because it's free and is over the air. I don't know how this thing plays. I don't know. I would not want to be sitting on the commission right now. But I just I think everything we've heard here today, that there are fewer voices, is true. But I don't know if you want the government to fix that. See, I don't know if you want the government cleaning up our mess.
What would be the alternative? That's always the big question. I think if the FCC does what it's been doing for the last 20 years, you're going to see more concentration. What's the alternative? We're just going to sit here and watch these outlets get sucked up into one or fewer companies?
I even believe, I think, with David Poltrek, that you talk about the people get what they deserve, but I think you have to trust the people to support minority voices and obscure genius and to celebrate that. We just had the producer of Oz. I wonder how many doors he knocked on before he sold that damn show to television. But I think you have to ultimately, those who want the government in there ultimately and essentially don't trust the people, I think.
This is a good question, I think, for all the panelists, and we'll go down the road. Please describe the best or worst recent news story or program you have seen with respect to your community. Let's talk with Tom down at the end.
Well, I'll describe a really bad news story because I think there's – this is actually – I don't know how recent this is, but during –
during the first season of the Survivor TV show, since we were talking about Survivor on another panel, there was KCTV, which is a television station in Kansas City, Missouri, aired as their lead news story a feature story about the first season of Survivor, which had no local connection to Kansas City at all. And the question is, does the fact that KCTV, which isn't even owned by CBS, but is an affiliate of CBS, is further relaxed? If CBS were allowed to purchase KCTV from Meredith, would we see more lead news stories about game shows that are on CBS, or would we see news stories that actually serve those local communities? Because I can tell you that the journalists who work in the newsroom at KCTV were really concerned about the directions that they were being given in terms of what they were to report. So I'll offer that, and I'll leave the good examples for someone else.
Tom Carpenter of AFTRA.
How about you, Katina? Can you think of something wherever you live? I'm not sure where you live, but something that really struck you as wrong that might, since we're talking about big media today, by a big broadcast station, and something where they're just missing the point entirely.
Well, one of the articles in the New York Times about the sniper case, a teacher in Maryland was quoted as saying that kids aren't really affected by what's going on, that kids are just going about their daily routine, and it's the parents that are really worried. Well, that's not true. I mean, these kids are locked inside their house. They're not allowed to go to school, and they're scared. But no one asked these kids that. Our reporters found three kids who were friends with the 13-year-old sniper victim in Maryland and interviewed them about how they felt. And they told our reporters, yes, I'm scared. Yes, I don't know. I want to go outside. I can't go to cheerleading practice in the park. I don't know why someone would want to kill my friend. These kids are scared, but nobody's asking them. No one's talking to them. They're harder to find, which is why. It's harder for adult reporters to talk to kids. But that's not any reason for them to be ignored. And I think with deregulation, it's not going to get better.
Do you have any examples of big media sort of being clueless about what's going on in their hometown?
Well, that was Katina Perrin, this, of Children's Press Line.
I think that big media is they're like a bunch of damn ducks following each other across the street. I've devoted 15 years of my life trying to get a failed baseball player with too many vowels in his name named Mario Cuomo into the White House. And George W. Bush, I think, has been an absolutely splendid president. I don't know whether you're Democrats or Republicans, Commissioner, so this is not for your benefit. But it seems like the press won't cut this guy a break. They say he's inarticulate, he doesn't carry himself well. But if anybody listened, and we carried it, but nobody heard it, he was talking about Page, John Page, I think, a signer of the Declaration, said to Thomas Jefferson, "Do you not know that an angel rides in this whirlwind?" Then he came back in his inaugural address, "I assure you an angel still rides in that whirlwind." On Mario Cuomo's best day, he never had a line as good as that. So I don't think that we've given, have given George Bush his due. I'm glad he's here.
William O'Shaughnessy of WVOX Radio, New Rochelle, New York.
Florence? Florence, specific example.
A specific example is many times they exaggerate, and especially when it comes to African-American and state in the news. And especially, I feel it many times they don't really have the facts of what has truly happened. And there's so many, really, there's so many things, the education system and how they totally have destroyed our children. So there's really so many things that I could, sort of talk to. But it bothers me that they have control. It bothers me how they have really dumbed down. I think most of our citizens are completely dumbed down because they're all quoting the same thing. And that's what disturbs me. Nobody thinks for themselves. Nobody reads other papers or get other news. So everybody's quoting what's been said on television. So that's what...
Dorothy?
Lawrence Rice of the Harlem Consumer Education Committee.
So many. Since I represent a multicultural organization and constituency, I would have to start with the coverage, the 9/11 coverage. In response, immediately after the 9/11 tragedy, the day that it happened, I was just pretty much appalled at the news that I watched.
What
bothered you about it? The assumption and the villainization of Middle Eastern people. In response, Third World News Reel did do, and they're on doing an ongoing response to give voice to Middle Eastern communities. And I realize that eventually the media did try to kind of balance out the representation of Middle Eastern people.
Sure.
It has to do with the sniper case again. With Malvo, the 17-year-old kid, he was a product of the foster care system. But none of that was ever portrayed accurately in the media. It's a bad kid, you know, under the thumb of this other guy. But the source of the problem, the source of the foster care system being a horrible system, and criminals, people, homeless, mental illness, are trapped in the system, get out and go on the street, and have to find their own way. And these are young people who don't have the guidance that other kids do in a parental situation. That story wasn't focused on the media. It might have been said, okay, foster care situation, but it wasn't, the background of that was never shown. It wasn't a full textured story as it could have been.
You know, here's another question sort of a different take on things. In examining ownership limits, should the FCC look at the business practices of corporate owners? And then specifically, what consideration should the FCC give to Clear Channel's business plan, which favors this voice tracking that Tom talked about? In other words, well, maybe turn it around and say, well, if a company does a lot of central casting or voice tracking or remote programming, should that be taken into account in the FCC rulemaking anyway? Tom?
Well, I would say that, you know, certainly there is a value to programming that is not local in origin. I mean, I think we all need to have information about national events and international events. But the difference, the reason that voice tracking is different than syndicated programming on radio, it's different than, you know, national news. And I think that when you've got a business plan like Clear Channels, which is essentially built on perpetrating a fraud on the public, where announcers are required to lie to listeners, to lie to local communities, and to pretend to be local and live when they are neither. I think it's axiomatic that a local community is not served by that big business practice. And so I would submit that when those licenses come up for renewal, or when these rules are being formulated, that if the FCC is going to protect the value of localism, that that certainly how much local programming is actually and in reality being aired on those airwaves is a relevant consideration.
But in order to get there, that assumes that you want the government evaluating your programming. I don't want the government evaluating my programming.
Or even to the extent of, well, local versus national, that doesn't seem like too much of a intrusion.
See, I don't have much problem with, I can get a good weather forecast for Sun Valley, Idaho, right here. So I realize that you want to have a lot of AFTRA members on your rolls, but I don't think the big is necessarily bad everywhere. Now, if you say there are the same old tunes, and I'm a wonderful, obscure artist, and I can only get played up in Woodstock, I will buy into that. But I don't know what the government can do for you on this. I don't know what you want the government to do.
Can I just respond briefly? You know, the airwaves are owned by the public. This is a public resource, and broadcasters are given licenses to exploit those airwaves by the government. And so the government is the trustee of those public trusts. And if a local broadcasting station is not meeting, if they're not a good trustee, a good custodian of this public resource, then I think it is absolutely appropriate for the government to have a role in evaluating whether or not the public good is being served by the way a broadcaster is using the airwave. You know, if that broadcaster has an obligation to the public to be a good citizen on the airwaves.
Well, this also bears on ownership. I think women are a question. Women are quantifiably underrepresented as news sources, subjects, and pundits, and are only a tiny percentage of decision makers at the media companies. I would also add that very few of them control the companies that control the networks, the big media companies, the TV station groups, the radio groups. Every year, Broadcasting Cable does a listing of the top 25 TV radio groups and who runs them, and I don't think too many women show up. Not too many African Americans or Hispanics either, for that matter. This documented problem, and I just documented it for you, only gets worse as the parent companies merge. Do the panelists have suggestions for improving the representation, participation of women? Let's also include minorities here in news and entertainment media. And how do they see deregulation factoring in? Dorothy, so the question is, what do you think the government can do, the FCC can do, to increase minority ownership or just minority management inside the TV and radio industry?
Well, I guess I would have to say making an effort to train and include minorities and women and from the very beginning, starting with young people. And I heard a couple of times today that diversity cannot be measured. But I disagree, because I think if we can't measure the diversity in America, we're really in trouble. We really have to make an effort and to be really honest with ourselves and look at the diversity and have a quantifiable measurement of the diversity in the people, the demographics of the U.S. And then the bottom line is... being from a struggling nonprofit organization, knowing that the bottom line is the bottom line, money, putting money into programs to make sure that the face of the gatekeepers change.
Florence, do you have any ideas of how we can increase the number of women and minorities in TV? Radio.
Well, what concerns me is the role that racism plays in our society. And I'm deeply concerned of how more and more African Americans are completely left out. And I'm saying African Americans. I'm not saying speaking about anyone. And I notice more and more they're being left out. So it's hard when you ask me a question like that, because you will see that I'm definitely concerned. We helped build this country, but slowly we're being slowly annihilated, and we're doing it through many ways. I say in this country, for African Americans in this country, that we're slowly being left out of many, many things, and that's my position.
Please talk out to the audience, Bill. You have any thoughts?
Florence, at the risk of someone thinking I'm patronizing you, you are the richest soul here in this whole day, and the most generous and intelligent soul. So I don't I just want to make that point. I have a unique situation in Westchester. I have a neighbor named Ossie Davis. And every time he is as close to sainthood as anyone I've ever met. He's a social activist, and he's always coming by with one of his causes. There's a guy in Washington named Pluria Marshall, I think one of his people here. And Pluria Marshall had a few designs on us about 20 years ago. And Ossie Davis called us and said, Pluria, what are you doing fooling around with my radio station? He said, Ossie, I didn't know you owned that radio station. He said, it's my hometown radio station, Pluria. I'll keep an eye on them. They watch my house when I go out on the road and do television things. So I've been, I don't know what that has to do with what we're talking about.
Let's start over again. You're very close to the broadcasting industry. What are they? What is the broadcasting industry doing? If anything, or are they resisting it? I know they've sort of more or less battled the EEO rules for years.
There's no question that my colleagues are cutting back. There's another Westchester station, since I haven't held anything back today, that has, in the last 10 years, they've had 9 owners and 43 general managers. And the roof, and you know, they're looking for ways to cut staff. Not only announcers, the roof leaks and they don't cut the lawn out in front. And I just love to terrorize them because we have a print ad that says another Westchester station has had 19 owners and 43 general managers. Is it possible the problem is not in the executive suite? So I like certain aspects of consolidation.
Katina?
Well, I think we're talking about government's role in getting more women and minorities into the media as sources, as media makers, things like that. I'm going to focus on the idea of starting off young with girls. And I think a lot of that is giving them the opportunity to know that that's a possibility for them, and instilling these practices in education and the government focusing on education policies that really do serve each and every child instead of middle-class white kids. So I think to getting young girls interested and getting them more involved, education would be the way to go.
Tom, and this is, I really think this is an important question, because if the big companies buy up all the stations, there's not going to be left anything left for entrepreneurs of any color. So, Tom, what do you think?
Well, I think the easy answer to that question is that there should be meaningful EEO regulations coming out of the FCC, and that those should apply, you know, I'll just take a narrow slice of that, that those should apply to part-time employees, which is very much an issue. But particularly when part-time employment is becoming the rule rather than the exception in broadcasting. But that's not my answer. My answer, actually, is that all of these regulations are related to the interests of minority communities. And if you look at the dual network rule, for example, NBC and Telemundo are now owned by the same company. They are combining their O&O stations in certain markets. They've already done it in Miami. It's in process in L.A. and in Chicago. And journalists are going to be working side by side in the same newsroom, sharing camera crews, sharing footage, and there's going to be the same content. So if you're a bilingual citizen of Chicago, you're getting access to you know, the same content in two different languages. Now, I think that's a fundamental disservice to local communities, and in particular to a minority community that has special needs from their from broadcasters that are serving the Spanish language market. But clearly the motivation for doing that is economic, that there are economies of scale that you get from selling advertising and exploiting that that market. But I would say that there are any number of examples how any of the rules, that relaxation of any of the rules could be cited as a way that minority communities are disadvantaged.
Well, there's a lot here, but we have to wrap it up. Thank you, panel. And can I bring up the other panel?
The panelists you've been listening to were Tom Carpenter of the AFTRA Union, National Director of the Broadcast Division, William O'Shaughnessy, President and CEO of two small radio stations in Westchester County, New York, WVOX and WRTN, Florence Rice of the Harlem Consumer Education Committee, Katina Perrin from Children's Press Line and Dorothy Thigpen, Executive Director of Third World Newsreel in New York. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's live continuing coverage. We have one more panel to go of the Forum on Media Ownership from Columbia University in New York. If you support this type of broadcast, we'd like to have you log on to our website and make a tax-deductible secure donation to www.pacifica.org. We received a few donations, but not nearly enough even to pay for our very modest costs of this broadcast today. And we've gotten a lot of calls here at KPFA where I am. I don't know about you, Robert Knight in New York, if you've been getting calls at WBAI. But
there's been a steady flow of off-air, offline calls.
Yeah, and all supportive and all very positive. So that's great, and we're happy to do this with our extremely reduced resources and wired together by our dedicated engineering staff headed by Jim Bennett out here at KPFA. But we do need a few hundred bucks to make this happen, actually a few thousand. So if anybody out there is so moved, $25 or $50 or $100 pledged to www.pacifica.org, you'll see a flashing icon or something like that. I haven't looked at it in hours. I'm sure it's still there. There's a secure way of doing it.
Well, Pacifica Radio is interested in the future of what one can listen to in broadcast rather than the profiteering of that. And our ability to, with a very dedicated crew, as dedicated as our listeners, to virtually overnight produce one of the most important broadcasts about broadcast is a testament to the mutual commitment between the producers and on-air community and the listener community. And I would like to suggest that if there are any listeners whose broadband access is routed through any of the corporate giants with the cross-ownership that we've been hearing about throughout the day, that for that very reason, that they would support a non-profit, a non-commercial, popular or populist radio network by clicking to Pacifica.org and letting us know, with the technology that is attempting to annihilate us, that we will prevail.
And Robert, the amounts of budgets that we have at these Pacifica stations and at our now non-existent network, which we're trying to rebuild, are dwarfed.
I wouldn't say it's non-existent, Larry. I think it's functioning quite well
ad hoc
after the institutional coma that was attempted by some of the same kinds of interests that we are describing today.
But it's now
our
ad hoc.
Our presence on this broadcast is testament to the survival and strength of Pacifica.
Yeah, we're trying to put it back together ad hoc, but what I'm saying is we no longer have a national news bureau, we no longer have national programs and things like that. We'll get them back together, folks, with your help. www.pacifica.org. Our next panel is a business people, Robert. You have a list of who we're probably about to hear, although they've thrown some changes at it for the last
minute. According to schedule, we'll be hearing from some executives from CBS Television, a member of NABET and CWA Union, that's the Communication Workers of America, and National Association of Broadcast Engineers and Technicians. Also, the president of MediaCom and a media analyst from Sanford Bernstein and Company.
It's also a billboard executive from Sherwood Outdoor, because a lot of the billboard companies are part of these synergistic conglomerates which own radio, television, billboard, internet sites, and everything else you can imagine. So let's see where they go with this discussion, brought to you uninterrupted when they're speaking by Pacifica Radio.
Non-commercially sponsored by the people who listen and who are hopefully even now clicking to Pacifica.org to support an independent radio network that operates in their listeners' benefit.
True enough. And after this panel is over, Robert and I will be sticking around to kind of sum up what went on today, and also, if there's time, I'll take some more listener phone-ins. We'll be going till 6 o'clock Eastern Time, 3 o'clock West Coast Time, so there should be time for more phone-ins. We did that before. We have a toll-free nationwide number. We had a lot of calls we couldn't get on the air, but we'll try to do it next time. We also have some guests scheduled for after the conclusion today, including someone talking about children's television.
We're ready to get started.
Back
again
to our moderator, who is not who I said it was before. It's actually Harry Jessel,
would
I believe.
Everybody please take their seats.
Who is New York editor of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. This is taking place at Columbia University Law School in New York, live as we cover it.
Thank you.
There's a large audience in the room that we are monitoring.
Everybody,
here,
please take their
remotely
seats
by television.
So we can get going.
Sometimes they try to ask or make comments from the audience, but that's not been allowed. They have to hand in little cards with questions on them.
Well, thanks for hanging in there all day. We still have two commissioners here. That's good to see. And a smattering of other FCC officials. So what you say will be heard. Business concerns, our final panel. Let's see, going from the far right, far end of the stage, Marty Franks, Executive Vice President, CBS Television, Senior Vice President of Viacom, Inc., one of those big five companies. Michelle Jennings, a researcher, Executive Vice President of Sherwood Outdoor. No, I guess not. You're with the... That's right. Billboard. James Joyce, Vice President, National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, Communications Workers of America. John Mandel, one of the big advertisers in the city, President and CEO, Mediacom. And Tom Wolzine, a media analyst. Sanford C. Bernstein knows this business as well as anybody. We're going to start with Marty Franks. Marty.
Thank you, Harry. The good news is that I won't subject you to my prepared statement. Having sat here all day long, I thought what might be most useful is if I just tried to react to some of the things I've heard. And so before I kind of dive in, I guess I want to make a few observations, if you'll permit me. First off, I almost wonder if we get up in the same universe every day. I've been at CBS for 16 years. It's the only media company I've ever worked at. So maybe my perspective is too narrow. But I live in a fiercely competitive environment where my competitors aren't just my colleagues at the other networks, but my competitors are, you know, Yahoo and Real Networks and EchoStar and a whole bunch of companies that when I started working at CBS didn't even exist. And so somehow the notion that the media landscape bears any resemblance today to what it looked like 5 years ago or 10 years ago, much less 60 years ago when a lot of these regulations were first written, is mind-boggling to me. Maybe I'm missing something. The other thing is, with respect, I mean, in a way, I guess it should be flattering to my male ego that so many people have been up here today talking about how powerful we are. And how good we are at executing our conspiracies so that we're able to weave this web of control across America. Folks, we're not that good. I mean, and we're not hiding UFOs in New Mexico either. Some of this is a little weird, folks. The folks that know me in the room have probably heard me say, quote, Eisenhower before. He was interviewed shortly after the end of the Second World War, supposedly by a fawning young female reporter who said, "General, how did you put together the magnificent Allied effort?" To which Eisenhower reportedly replied, "Young woman, if the Allies won the war, consider what the other side must have been like." We're not that good. So kind of step back a little bit. There isn't this vast big media conspiracy out there to somehow subvert the underlying values of America. All right, thank you. I've gotten that out of my system. What I'd really like to do with the remainder of my time before Harry starts yanking on me is to if I may, I will stay here until the lights are, I will stay in the room. I'll be happy to talk to any of you until they kick us out on the curb to answer any questions you want to. If you really want to talk about the UFOs in New Mexico, we can do that too. But I want to use my little bit of allotted time to go back to where Chairman Powell started us this morning. The proceeding before us is somewhat circumscribed by the mandate of the Congress. I mean, it's the law, and by the rulings of the courts. So there's a whole lot that's been discussed today, and some of them are very valid issues, but in some cases you're in the wrong venue. I mean, if there is some tinkering perhaps that the commission can do on radio, but if you've got a big problem with the radio, say the radio world, you got to go back to Congress. Congress deregulated radio, not the FCC. So let me just try and touch on a couple of points. 35% cap. I was interested to hear, you know, a lot of talk about localism. The pattern of television ownership in the, in this country today is big group owners. We're one of them, but so is Cox and the Washington Post, the New York Times, and they aren't local stations. I mean, they're all kind of managed from a distance. And if in the panel this morning where the woman spoke about studying local news, for purposes of the commission's proceeding, if her study said most local news isn't very good. I mean, I dispute her on that point, but I'll grant it for the purpose of this argument. I didn't hear her say that affiliates that are owned by non-network owners, in Cox, Washington Post, do a better job of local news than we do. That would be, to me, an argument for not letting us own more stations because there would be a demonstration that somehow we weren't doing it as well as the other people. That's not in the record. If you can prove that in the record, put it in. We put our evidence in the record that it's to the contrary. I live in Washington, D.C. I happen to think, with all due respect, that the CBS affiliate in Washington, which is now owned by the Gannett Company, was a better station when it was owned by the Washington Post Company. So, that, you know, in terms of network, or excuse me, station, newspaper, cross-ownership, give me one more minute here. I mean, if you took Washington, where there are two O&Os, Fox and NBC, and you took the station owned by Joe Allbritton and the station owned by Gannett, and you could show that then the Allbritton Gannett stations were better at doing local than the Fox and NBC stations, you'd have an argument to make to the commission. But to say that all local news is bad doesn't play in within the fairly circumscribed fight they have. I know I'm going to have to sit down in a minute. Let me just make one pitch. Free television is much more endangered than I've heard articulated in this room. Some of what we are seeking, the network business, two of the networks, NBC and CBS, will make money this year. The other two are going to lose a ton. One of the reasons is because all the programming investment is made at the network level. Much of the recouping of that investment is made at the station level. If we're not able to own more stations and therefore recoup more of our programming investment will decline. When our programming investment declines, as it has at NBC in the sports arena, more and more sports goes to pay. How that's not anti-American, it's not ultimately in the public's interest if programming that they've come to expect on free television of the highest quality, might dispute whether you like Survivor or not, but if this weekend's playoffs are going to be on for free for everybody to watch. I'm sorry the Jets didn't make it. And we are only a couple of years away, perhaps, if we don't make some progress on these rules, from that going away. I'll stop. I would love to answer questions either up here or I'll stick around as long as people want to talk. Thank you.
Michelle Jennings.
It was Martin Franks, Executive Vice President of CBS Television and Viacom. This is Michelle Franks from Sherwood Outdoor Advertising.
Thank you for allowing me to have my voice heard in this important discussion. America's airwaves have always been and should always be held in the public trust. The American people own the airwaves, and the programming is entrusted to be in the public's best interest. If we believe that, and I do, then the deregulation of the radio industry has been an unmitigated disaster. Many media executives and programmers share my view, but are afraid to speak out publicly because their livelihoods are dependent upon upholding and promoting an opposite view. Friends and colleagues in the industry have warned me that I may be blackballed if I speak out against deregulation at this event. Radio has been crushed in the embrace of two 800-pound gorillas. I am here today to bear witness to the effects that deregulation has had on the radio industry. I have been a radio broadcast executive for 25 years. As executive vice president and general sales manager of Media America for 13 years, I represented producers who provide programming for radio stations in exchange for commercial inventory. Media America was, and still is, the largest independent radio network in the United States. Prior to deregulation, this was a flourishing business. Program providers benefited from a level playing field, and companies that offered better and more cost-efficient programming could go toe-to-toe with industry giants. After deregulation, the competitive landscape altered drastically. Our business contracted, and our ability to grow was dramatically diminished. Clear Channel and Viacom, which collectively reach an audience that is larger than the next 35 largest radio broadcast groups combined, all but stopped taking programming from outside sources with deregulation. Both of these companies are vertically integrated. This means that they not only own the stations, they produce the network radio programming, which is in turn sold through their network radio sales organizations. After deregulation, both corporate headquarters decreed that all radio programming should be developed from within their respective companies, so the best programming no longer wins. To better understand the effects deregulation has had on my industry, let's go from the broad to the specific. Rush Limbaugh aired exclusively on KMBR in San Francisco, which is owned by Susquehanna Broadcasting. Rush was the crown jewel, their crown jewel. KSFO, the ABC station in San Francisco, wanted to get Rush for their station. Meanwhile, the ABC station in New York, WABC, was airing Lars Lessinger, and the show was tanking. New York's WABC wanted to get rid of Laura and replace her show with something else. Clear Channel, which owns both Rush and Laura, used its leverage to force a deal on the ABC station group. WABC was strong-armed to keep Laura on the air, in return for which the ABC station KSFO in San Francisco was allowed to take Rush away from its competitor KNBR. Clear Channel manipulates the market to achieve their corporate objective, regardless of the public's interest. Media America was the exclusive advertising representative for the Weather Channel radio network since 1993. In 1999, Media America lost this rep contract to Clear Channel. Clear Channel made a guarantee to the Weather Channel of station clearances if they signed with them. These are stations that wouldn't or weren't allowed to carry the service when we repped it. We couldn't guarantee what they could because we didn't own the radio stations. I think this is just wrong. Media America's rep BDS, the music monitoring service owned by BNU, that is used by program directors and record companies to track airplay of competitive stations. BDS is a great service, but not one of the 1,240 Clear Channel stations can utilize it because they have to use MediaBase, a competitive service, because it's owned by Clear Channel. Clear Channel also controls 66% of the concert promotion business in this country. Hence, record labels and artists are beholden to Clear Channel. They mandate that artist management must work with the Clear Channel promoter in order to play in the Clear Channel venue. When an artist goes on tour, Clear Channel will demand exclusive radio interview and exclusive promotion rights. If you, as an artist, go to another radio station or promoter, then Clear Channel can not only not play your song, but they can keep you out of the venue. They own the bat, the ball, and the ballpark. Clear Channel and Viacom are the twin 800-pound gorillas who control the America airways, and deregulation has created these King Kongs. Who loses? The public loses, big time. I strongly urge you to fully consider the effects deregulation has had on the radio industry. The broadcast medium needs to be held in the public trust. It is this trust that I call on you now to preserve and protect. Thank you for your time and attention.
Michelle Jennings, Executive Vice President of Sherwood Outdoor Advertising.
James Joyce of NABIT.
Good afternoon. My name is James C. Joyce, and I am the Vice President of the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA, otherwise known as NABIT. NABIT CWA is a labor organization representing thousands of broadcast professionals at the ABC and NBC television networks, at the ABC radio network, and had owned and operated ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox television stations, radio stations, and other broadcast facilities across the country. NABIT CWA also represents workers at smaller group-owned television and radio stations and also at independently owned outlets. All of our members could potentially be impacted by changes to the existing FCC ownership rules. Since 1992, NABIT has been affiliated and is now merged with the Communications Workers of America, or CWA. CWA also serves as the parent organization for the Newspaper Guild, which represents journalists and other newspaper professionals who, along with CWA-represented printers, might be impacted by changes to the current media ownership rules. In total, CWA represents more than 700,000 employees, all of whom depend upon a diverse and vibrant media to be informed and active citizens in our democracy. CWA has filed formal comments in this proceeding in support of structural rules to ensure media diversity, competition, and localism. Copies of our FCC filing are available outside. I believe they've now been moved to in front of the 116th Street entrance by the guard. There are also some other supporting documents out there. Or you can go to the web to see the filings and these supporting documents at www.saveourmedia.org. NABIT CWA has already experienced the effect of duopolies on our members and on consumers here in New York and in Los Angeles. In July 2001, the commission, based on the earlier relaxation of the large market duopoly and local ownership rules, granted approval to News Corporation, the parent of Fox television stations, to purchase Chris Kraft Industries. As a result, Fox now owns two stations in New York City, WWOR-TV, Channel 9, and WNYW-TV, Channel 5. And they own two television stations in Los Angeles, KTTV, Channel 11, and KCOP, Channel 13. Prior to the purchase, NABIT CWA represented the technicians at WWOR-TV, which, as most tri-state residents know, is physically based in Secaucus, New Jersey. And NABIT represented technicians and news writers at KTTV in Los Angeles. By the way, WWOR-TV is the only commercially operated full-power VHF television station in the state of New Jersey. In fact, two decades ago, it was the FCC that prompted WWOR-TV's prior owners, RKO General, to move the station to New Jersey in order to promote diversity. In the spring of 2002, in order to facilitate and maintain union representation at the merged properties, NABIT CWA and the International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees, IATSE, entered into an agreement that NABIT CWA would represent all the technicians and news writers at the Fox-owned properties in Los Angeles, and in exchange, IATSE would then represent the employees at the Fox properties in New York. Both unions were concerned that years of collective bargaining gains would otherwise be left in the dust of the merger, and this arrangement was the one aspect of the merger in which we had some limited voice. What has common ownership meant for the Fox duopolies in Los Angeles and New York City? Fox has merged station and news management in both cities. Almost immediately after Fox took over in August 2001, Fox put in one general manager and one news director over the two Los Angeles stations, and one general manager and one news director over the two New York City stations. In Los Angeles, there's been some commingling of crews and reporters sharing of news tape footage. NABIT CWA anticipates this commingling will accelerate now that station staff has merged as of January 6, 2003, primarily since Fox plans to reduce the overall technician staffing levels by one-third. We also understand that Fox plans to physically merge the facilities of the two Los Angeles stations into the KTTV facility late this upcoming spring. Already, KTTV's newscast was reduced and switched in June of 2002 from an hour at 10 to a half hour at 11, reducing viewer accessibility to news programming in that market. In New York City, Fox has a